hell that I was in, I'd do anything to be better.
I thought like a lunatic.
You kind of just have like that little bit of hope that it will get better.
You're gonna make it.
This began my surrender.
I am a witness of my own growth.
It's a life beyond your wildest dreams, and I just have to say, it works if you work it.
My story, that's what I share.
You're listening to Far From Finished, a weekly podcast where we share new, real-life stories of hope and triumph, told by the people who live them. Today's story comes to us from...
My name is Andrea, and my sobriety date is September 27th, 2011. Life before addiction, I don't even totally remember, because I think that I'm a true believer that, you know, some people say I was born an addict, and I'm not totally convinced that I was, but I definitely know that when I started my teen years and I started entering love relationships with boys, and I'm calling them boys because, you know, when you're 15, 16, you're very young. And that's really when my codependence started. And looking back on it, I can definitely see that that was a big problem, and that was an addiction of mine. And also love addiction. That's what entered my life at that time, and well into my 20s. I used men and relationships as my higher power. I used it to validate myself. I used it to give me self-worth. And it really is similar to alcohol for me, in that I was obsessed with the other person. I was obsessed with fixing a relationship I was in. I was obsessed with whomever my love interest was at the time. And it was definitely a shame cycle, you know, just like drinking is. So people often, you know, some people don't know what really love addiction looks like, and sometimes they mix it up with sex addiction, and those were two very different things for me. What I did was, you know, behavior wise, what it looked like was I was in a relationship the whole time this was going on. I would, for instance, I'd like go out with my girlfriends, and I would kind of scan the crowd for someone that I thought was attractive, and kind of the chase was on, and I would go and see if I could, you know, entice this person, and whether it was just a lot of flirting or whether it was something more than that, that's what I did all the time. And as soon as, you know, there were some instances where the guys that I was with wanted to have a relationship, and that was when I would end things. Partly because I was in a relationship with someone else, and partly because it was too much for me. And really, in retrospect, like, this was not something I knew at the time. This was something that, in hindsight, that I realized through a lot of therapy and in recovery, was that love and intimacy and trust really was the things that I wanted the most in my life, and connection. Those were the things that I wanted the most and that I was searching for through my codependence and through my love addiction. It was also the things that I was terrified of the most. So I confused these quote unquote relationships with love and connection and intimacy. And the reality was, I didn't know what that looked like at all. So that was really the story of my 20s. And in terms of alcohol, I was drinking, and there was definitely some binge drinking going on as I would go out. I'm from San Diego, and there's plenty of places to go out and get in trouble when you're a young person in San Diego. And we certainly did that. And I don't really look back at my habits and think that it was sadly anything different than what was going on at the time with a lot of young people. I hesitate to use the word normal because, I mean, we were doing some serious drinking. And as far as like my mind, I could take it or leave it. I don't think that I had crossed the line into alcoholism then, because I didn't need it. I had other addictions that I was leaning on as my coping skills, like that was working for me. You know, they say it works until it doesn't. That at the time was working for me. It was working to push everything away from my life, push people away from my life, to remain emotionally inept, to, you know, live this kind of life of just being emotionally absent in my life. So again, love addiction and codependence worked. I was also in and out of an eating disorder during that time in my life. I depends on if I was going through a crisis or not. If I was, I felt like my weight and the size of my jeans I could control. And it was something that I fell on. There was a period of time where it got really bad in my late 20s. where my mom sort of did an intervention, and I had lost a lot of weight, and I was pretty sick. I think I was in a lot of denial too of how bad that was. My hair was falling out. I was constantly hungry. I was not sleeping well, and I'd go to bed and my heart would be racing. I was probably also dehydrated. I was not treating my body well at all in terms of that. And that was also an obsession. I would obsess on how many calories I was eating, how many calories I was burning, if I got to work out that day, how many times I got to work out that day, what I was eating, the size of my pants. And, you know, it was an awful prison to live in from a mind place. And then what ended up happening is I got help for those things. I got help for my love addiction. And kind of the ironic thing that's sort of funny, not funny, is that I was in a my marriage fell apart. You know, the person that I had been with that I mentioned, I was with him for 13 years. And we ended up getting married, and it was a very dramatic breakup. And then I entered a relationship very quickly with someone who was also a love addict. And we were a match made in hell, really. And he was also a drug addict, and I did not know it. And he got sent to the Meadows and by a family member, and I went for family week. And that's when I was introduced to what love addiction was. I had already talked a lot to my therapist about codependence and was still kind of like, I don't know. I still think everybody else needs to get themselves together. And then, you know, then everything would be, I was not ready to take any responsibility fully. Like, I was kind of looking at my own stuff a little bit, but I was still not ready. But when I went there to the Meadows, I was introduced to these other things and really started to take responsibility for my own life on those terms, and went home and got help, started going to 12-step program for codependence, and started being really honest with my therapist, and we started diving into those addictions, and I felt really good, and I was doing the work, and I was getting help for those things, and I mean, almost like to the day, my drinking picked up, and that's when it really sort of exploded. And it started, that was also right around the time, through that healing and recovery, I met someone amazing and had a couple children, and I also wasn't working anymore, so I was a stay-at-home mom. My identity totally shifted. I was really bored, quite honestly. I had hoped and prayed that motherhood would be this thing where the heavens opened up and this would be my savior and this would fulfill me like no other. You know, it's like we all have that hole in our heart, and I thought motherhood was going to fill that up, because it certainly wasn't men. It certainly wasn't, you know, control. It certainly wasn't, you know, saving other people and or having the thinnest body I could. So I surely thought motherhood was it, and turns out it wasn't. So I was bored and afraid, and I also had all these things that had happened in my life that I had never fully processed. I had had an abortion that I was so torn up about when I was a teenager that I hadn't told that many people and never really processed it. Had huge amounts of shame around that. My parents got divorced when I was 18, and I did not even know that they were mad at each other, let alone headed for divorce. And I was also date raped when I was 20. So I had these huge things that had happened to me when I was younger and that I had never processed. And I know that was contributing to a lot of my behaviors that were not helpful. And that's why I started drinking again, because I needed to shut all that out. I didn't know how to cope with life. I didn't know how to deal with grief. And I had a lot of, I don't even call it anger. I had a lot of rage. I had so much rage, and I would take it out on other people. And I definitely took that out on my ex-husband. But when I got married to a different, healthier person and then had these children, I drank to stuff it all down. And it worked for a little while. I definitely kind of like went from that like fun category, and I dropped into fun with problems. And it got to a point where I remember the first time I drank an entire bottle of wine by myself, like on a Tuesday. Like it wasn't even like day drinking at a Super Bowl party. It wasn't a weekend anniversary. It was like a regular Tuesday, and I realized I drank the whole thing, like opened the bottle, and then the next day I knew it was empty. And I didn't want my husband to see the bottle, so I ended up hiding it in the trunk of my car. It was in the garage. And it was like these small, you know, people ask me like, what was your bottom? I didn't have a rock bottom where I never had any DUIs. I did not go to jail. I didn't lose my kids. I definitely identify with having a high bottom where I knew what was happening. And I do want to say I have my father to thank for that. My dad got sober right after my mom left when I was 18, and he was a high functioning alcoholic. I never even saw my dad drink, but he told me that sometimes he would put away a 12 pack a night, and never saw him drunk, never even saw my dad angry. So I just thought everybody's dad drank a lot of beers at night. And so my dad got sober. And when he died last year, he had more than 20 years of sobriety. So I knew kind of like what my destiny might be. And I knew about 12-step programs. I had already done Codependence Anonymous. I knew that this might be happening. And there was a part of me that was kind of pissed, because I was like, you know, I have dealt with my codependence. I've dealt with my love addiction. I've dealt with my eating disorder. Please don't take this away from me. Like, can I just have one thing? Like, I don't smoke pot anymore. Like, you know, I only did cocaine a few times. I can't do that anymore. I'm a mom. Can I just drink the dang wine? And I went through that whole, those stages. And I was angry. I was scared. I was ashamed. And there was a couple more incidences that were red flags. What I would do is I would have a couple of glasses. I had a rule, you know, as we do. I had a rule that I would not start drinking until Oprah's show came on. So this was back when Oprah still had her show at 4 o'clock every day. And so at 4 o'clock, I would get out a glass, you know, a glass of wine, and then my husband would come home about 5 o'clock. So I would already have a couple of glasses of wine by then. So before he came home, like as he was pulling into the driveway, I would put my wine glass in the dishwasher and then wait about a half an hour or an hour when he was home and I was making dinner and get out a new glass and pour myself a glass of wine. So it seemed like I was just starting, you know, to have my first glass of wine for the night, when the reality was I was already like two, sometimes three glasses in. And I knew that that probably wasn't a good thing to be doing and that not everybody did that. And then another time I had done that. He was pulling into the driveway. I had put my glass in the dishwasher and I went to take the bottle of Chardonnay or Pinot Grigio to put it in the refrigerator. And before I set it down, I pulled the cork back out and started chugging from the bottle just to like get a few more ounces in, like this desperation. And I remember having this really lucid moment of, does my life suck so bad that I feel like I need to do this? Like, is this necessary? And again, another like pinprick. I use a metaphor sometimes of like, it's like a water balloon and like these little things that happen, like prick holes in it with a pin. And then pretty soon it's like gushing. That's what was starting to happen. And the last thing that happened was it was during the day. And, you know, at that point my kids were little. They were like, you know, maybe 2.5 and an infant, or maybe they were 3 and 1. And we were going to go out into the cul-de-sacs. So I could like pull them around in the wagon, which is just was really boring for me. You know, it's like somebody just shoot me. And I just was so bored. And I had an empty bottle or an empty can of Diet Coke. And I rinsed it out and poured Merlot in it and went out into the cul-de-sac. You know, it was like probably 2 o'clock in the afternoon, you know, all in an effort, because it would be weird if I was out there like with a glass of wine, with, you know, pulling my kids around the cul-de-sac, and if I ran into any neighbors. And so that was a way for me to do that. And I thought I was brilliant. You know, I thought like that was pretty smart of me. But again, you know, my intuition was saying like, that's probably not normal. And the breaking point was one of my really good friends at the time had her birthday fell on Super Bowl. So it was February of 2011. And it was day drinking. And I always used to look forward to like any excuse to have something like that was just like so fantastic. And so I got so drunk at her birthday party / Super Bowl party. I probably had like probably 8 glasses of wine, and I came home and just was bawling my eyes out and telling my husband, I think I need to get sober. And he was like, what are you talking about? Because again, nobody knew that there was a problem. I covered it up pretty well. I made it my full-time job to hide it. And I had done a pretty damn good job. And so he was like, okay, you know, and that's great, I guess. And then And then I was embarrassed the next day. And then a few days later, I called a friend of mine who had, at the time, I think she probably had 7 or 8 years of really great recovery. And I was even ashamed to tell her. And she was someone who had never judged me for any other reason. But again, I think I expected her to like gasp when I told her, I think I need to get sober. And she didn't gasp. She just said, okay, how can I help you? Like, what do you need from me? And she was just so great. And she helped me through it. And I ended up going and, you know, people ask me like, oh, did you have withdrawals or anything like that? I didn't. I don't believe that I was physically addicted. I think it was all emotional and mental for me. And then I went, started going to 12-step program meetings and had a few really great months of recovery. So that was May of 2011 that happened. It was actually Mother's Day. It was my first sobriety date. And then what ended up happening is I got into an argument with my husband on September 26th of that same year. And it was very, very triggering for me. You know, anyone who's been in a relationship, you know, who has past relationship breakups, you probably have abandonment issues, right? Or family of origin stuff. And, you know, I'm no exception. And so we got into this argument, which is a pretty rare occurrence for us. And so I automatically went down that rabbit hole of like, this is it. He's going to leave, you know, just like they all do. And I was pretty broken up about this particular argument and fiercely triggered. And I talked to my sponsor and she told me to read this one particular part of the Big Book. And I did that. And I was doing all the things that I was supposed to do. And, you know, I wasn't alone. And then I ended up having to go back home and I was alone for a moment. And I thought to myself, I remember hearing an AA speaker talk about how she used to drink vanilla extract. And I didn't even know that that was like a thing. And I knew that I didn't want to drink. Like I didn't want to like get out a bottle of wine or go buy alcohol. I knew that you know, I didn't want to do that. And so I thought, well, I've heard also that if you drink NyQuil, you can get your buzz off that. So, I mean, it was probably within 30 seconds. I was in the bathroom chugging a bottle of cherry NyQuil and stood there for just a couple of minutes probably and was like, well, I don't feel anything. So I'm going to go get some vanilla extract. So at the time I was at my mom's house, actually, we were staying with her for a couple of months because we just moved. And I went to the pantry and there was a bottle of vanilla extract and I opened that sucker up and started drinking it and it was disgusting. And I looked at the bottle and all the sediment had like settled at the bottom of this bottle and it was like kind of, then it was like floating around in it. And I looked closer and it had expired in 2005. Like I was drinking this vanilla extract that had expired years before. It was like in the back of my mom's pantry. I'm surprised it was even back there. And I thought to myself, what am I doing? What am I doing? Like, this is crazy. And I felt like such crap about it. And then I got a case of the, you know what, it's, and I opened up a bottle of wine and drank it. And that later that night, I think that my mom and stepdad had probably come home and my husband was home and I don't even think we had spoken yet. And I was downstairs with my son and both my kids were jumping on the bed and I had put the bottle of wine, because at that point like I didn't even care, I was like drinking it straight from the bottle, and I had hid it in this like kind of hallway cabinet thing, and I was sitting in the doorway right next to the cabinet so I could see inside the room where my kids were playing and jumping on the bed. And I lean over and I pull the bottle out of this cabinet and I'm drinking from it, and my son was, he had to have been 4 at the time, and he just turned 4. And he said, he saw me drinking from it and he stopped jumping on the bed and he said, Mommy, what are you doing? Because it probably looked funny. You know, like, why is she drinking out of a bottle? You know, he didn't know that it was wine or anything like that, but it just probably looked strange. But just him, like that moment of him stopping and looking at me and saying, like, what are you doing? And I started crying and I said, I don't know. And at that point, I was almost done with the bottle and I poured the rest out. And that was September 26, 2011. And that was the last time I drank. And I haven't told that story in a long time, the relapse story. And I think I needed to do that because I was questioning I was in recovery, but I was questioning myself because I had such a high bottom. And I was hearing all these stories of these people who had completely screwed up their lives and just really had these stories of hard struggle and losing people in their lives and ruining relationships. And I didn't have that. And I didn't feel like my story was good enough. I didn't feel like I was a good enough alcoholic. And I know that that can be, that's going down the path of relapse right there, of looking for the differences in people's stories. You know, there was another woman who had told a story about like losing her kids. And like, I wasn't even near that. And all I knew is that, you know, I really had to admit to myself, like, that very well could be me, you know, and if I kept up, it was the progress of my drinking was really scaring me terribly. How quickly I had gone from you know, just one glass a night to an entire bottle. And I was like, what's next? You know, like, I could drink two bottles of wine. Like, I could easily be that. Is that going to be every night? And also knowing what that was doing to my body. And I think that the biggest thing for me was I didn't want my children to grow up with a drunk mom. You know, I didn't want to be that mom. And I already have a big personality, and I'm forthright, and I say things that I mean, and I'm very direct. When I'm drinking, I don't have any tact, and I'm not kind about it. So I didn't want to be that person. I definitely am not proud of how I show up in those moments. So there were so many reasons of you know, why I knew that sobriety was the absolute path I had to go. And I needed to prove that to myself. Like, okay, yeah, I definitely am an alcoholic. Like, no questions. So now I will never have to ask myself that again. Like, the question in the last 6 years has never arisen. Like, do I really think I'm an alcoholic? Like, that night, it is a absolute yes. Like, if I ever question it again, I just need to remember the NyQuil and vanilla extract that was long expired, and knowing that's how an alcoholic thinks. Like, oh, if I just drink this, but I'm not technically drinking, but I can just get a buzz from it. Like, that's alcoholic thinking. I did not go to like an inpatient treatment center or anything like that. Or even an outpatient treatment center. I went to AA, and that's where I had a sponsor, and my first sponsor didn't work out, and I got a different sponsor that ended up really working out. And yeah, that's how I got sober. How recovery has changed my life is, I think when I get asked that question, it mostly, the things that really stand out to me of how things have changed is the emotional change. And what's kind of funny is that when I walked into the rooms, and I mean, I had known about the 12 steps and I had gone through them in Codependence Anonymous, and it had been years prior. But in 2011, when I went, I was already, I am a life coach by trade. That's what I do. And I had gotten certified in 2000. I started my training in 2008 and I was having babies. So it took me a while to get all that done. But 2009, 2010 is when I got my certification and started my business. So I was well versed in personal development. So when I walked into the rooms and, you know, see these 12 steps that I need to do, I had a major ego problem, and I had a kind of a chip on my shoulder too. I was like, well, I've already done so much personal development. Like, I don't know if I really need to do this. And I asked my sponsor about it. And I asked my friend about it too. The one I mentioned who I talked to when she lived in a different city, about getting sober. And she was so kind too. She's like, well, yes. And you might really just want to try this. Maybe it's just like supplemental, when really she should have just smacked me over the head. But I did, of course, the 12 steps. And really, I think what was helpful is, yes, the 12 steps were helpful. And what was unexpected for me was that, you know, they say that when we start our addictions is when we stop growing emotionally. So for me, if I'm really honest, I do think that I stopped growing emotionally when I was a teenager. So I had like no experience in dealing with my emotions in a healthy way. I always pushed them aside and offloaded all of my hurt. And when I say that, I mean, I was a blamer. Everything was always somebody else's fault. And I also stockpiled. So I would just let things happen and get angrier and angrier and angrier, and then completely blow up at somebody and just lose my mother loving mind. And it was scary. It was scary for everyone around me. And it was even scary for me. Like, something would take over. So what ended up happening is in 2011, when I did get sober, and I had been divorced from my first husband for 5 years at that point, and I was remarried and had two children. So all the grief from those things that happened to me that I mentioned prior when I was younger, as well as the grief of my divorce, sort of exploded in my face. Like, I don't have any other way to explain it, but I was not expecting that to bubble back up. And it did. And now it doesn't surprise me that that came up. And, you know, I was having dreams about it and figuring out what my triggers were and really becoming very self-aware of that. And the good news was, is that once I realized what was happening, I was able to talk to the right people, whether that was my therapist or really good friends that I have that I trust that also kind of know about this work. So I could say things out loud that I was feeling, and also writing is something that I use as a tool for creativity, as well as being able to process things that I don't understand. I know that's the case for many people, whether you're a writer or whether you are, you know, a singer or whatever creative outlet that you do. For me, it helps tremendously. And also having better coping skills and to deal with life stuff, because the unfortunate thing is when we get sober, hard stuff doesn't stop happening. Like, hard stuff continues to happen, but we're better equipped, you know, to deal with it. And, you know, there's some people that aren't, of course, but they're still sober, but they don't deal with it well. But there's a lot of people that do. And I feel confident enough to, you know, I'm not a perfect person by any means, but I feel confident enough that I now am able to own what's mine. So when I make a mistake, I am begrudgingly sometimes, but I'm able to make amends for it and try to make things right as best I can and see where I have screwed up. You know, this is like to my children on the regular. I just yesterday had to apologize to my daughter. I was mad about something else. It was the anniversary of my father's death, and I was upset about that and triggered about some other stuff. And I got mad at her the other morning for something that really wasn't that big of a deal. And I had to apologize to her after school. And what's funny is she was like, I don't even remember that this morning. So anyway, but that's one thing that how my life has changed is just being emotionally mature and emotionally healthy and being able to talk about my feelings and know that they matter, because for a long time I felt like my feelings didn't matter. I grew up in a home where we had one feeling and that was happy. And if you were any other of the feelings, you went and did that on your own. And I think that my parents absolutely did the best that they could, but they didn't have a lot of tools to talk about the hard stuff or sit with me when I had hard stuff, like when my boyfriend broke up with me when I was 14, or somebody made fun of me in seventh grade, or, you know, these things that happen as children. Like, my parents just didn't have the skills to sit with me in that pain and struggle. So I grew up in a house where we just didn't talk about the hard stuff. We just swept it under the rug, hoped that it went away. There's a saying that says, like, you can't bury your feelings alive and expect them to die. And I think that was my family's motto. Like, we wanted to bury the feelings alive and hoped and prayed that they died, and they didn't. And again, that all came to the surface when I got sober, and I've had to have some hard conversations with my mom. And I've had to have hard conversations with a lot of people, and they're never fun. Like, I'm not going to sit here and pretend like, oh, you get sober, it's so easy. But I'll tell you, it's a hell of a lot better than stuffing it all down with booze and just like trying to pretend that all of that doesn't exist, because you know, we get to that point where it works until it doesn't. And I was definitely at that point where it was not working anymore. For anybody that's looking into getting help or really struggling, I think that a couple of things. I think follow your intuition. I do believe that, you know, for the sake of sounding really esoteric, it's your soul speaking. I think that it's your best self, your spirit saying, like, this is what we need. This is the next step that needs to happen so that you can live your best life, so that you can go on to the next thing in your life. And I think having a support system is essential. You know, I think what happens to some people when they think about, you know, getting sober and getting into recovery is that they tell the wrong people. And the people to tell are not your drinking buddies, most likely. You know, the people to tell are not the people who you know also have a problem, because it's going to bring up their stuff as well. So whether it's a therapist or a counselor or, you know, there's so many 1-800 numbers out there, like crisis centers or recovery centers, or even like the main Alcoholics Anonymous number. Those people, I think it never ceases to amaze me how much people are like, oh, I don't want to go to a meeting in my area because I might see somebody there I know. And I'm like, they're there because they're an alcoholic. They're not going to be like, oh my God, you're here. They're going to hug you and say, welcome home. I saved you a seat. Like, that's what, like, it, but I understand that. You know, I went to my very first meeting in my most expensive jeans and like my hair and makeup done. Because I wanted to look like I, you know, like if I'm going to tell you that I'm having a problem with alcohol, you bet your butt I'm going to look good on the outside. And that's, you know, again, that was like my ego walking in. So I totally understand what that's like. Like, it's not easy to walk in like broken and bruised up and admitting that you're in this major struggle, because we have such a judgment about that, you know, and to live is to struggle. Like, none of us get out of this without any struggle. And that was so hard for me to admit. You know, I come from a legacy of very strong women, and that was tough. That was really, really tough. What's also interesting is that when I got sober, my second, you know, my real sobriety date, it was a few months later, and I remember, I will never forget it. I sat up in bed and I said to myself, I am gonna write a book. And it had been something that I had wanted to do forever, because I've always been a writer, but I actually took like a 12-year hiatus when I had kind of lost myself there in my 20s. And so I did. I wrote a book and I got a book deal, and that was amazing and kind of like surprised me. And because I'm a life coach again, like I mentioned. And so that one is all about self-help, and it's like a bunch of, it's called 52 Ways to Live a Kick-Ass Life. And that was published in 2013. And now in January of 2018, I have my second book coming out called How to Stop Feeling Like Shit. And that book was born because I'm certified in the work of Dr. Brené Brown. And if somebody's not familiar with her, she's a researcher, and she has spent the majority of her career studying topics like vulnerability and shame and courage and authenticity, which, if you're an alcoholic, like, you know, these are topics that are so important to our recovery. And part of the work that I do based on her research is something that she calls armor. So the armor are the things, like these behaviors that we do when we're trying to avoid criticism, judgment, and shame. And one of those pieces of armor is numbing out. And some other common ones are things like perfectionism. For some people, it's people pleasing. It's also like chronic control, which can also be codependence. And so there's like all these quote unquote pieces of armor. And what was happening is I would take clients through this work and we would get to that lesson and they would resonate so much with it and those behaviors. And so I thought to myself, I have to write a book about this. So I have come up with 14 of them. The subtitle of the book is 14 Habits That Are Holding You Back from Happiness. And I go in depth to each behavior and have stories from people of what it looks like in their life. And then also stories of people who have come out of it and lots of tools. The book has a lot of tools on how to practice choosing other behaviors. So it's not about not doing those behaviors, because we're going to do them because it's what we know. I still engage in perfectionism every once in a while, or control. But it's about, like I was saying before, like knowing that you're in it, like, oh, this is what I'm doing. And choosing other behaviors, because I can guarantee you, like, it never feels good to engage in people pleasing. It never feels good to engage in numbing out. Like, it might momentarily, but at the end of the day, like, we're not proud of ourselves for that. Like, nobody has a value around isolating and hiding out or self-sabotage. So it's really about getting to know quickly when you're in it, so that you can choose a different behavior.